January the 26th, 1962, Lecture 24. January the 26th, 1962, Lecture 24.
January 26th, 1962, Lecture 24, Resonance. January 26th, 1962, Lecture 24, Resonance. January 26th, 1962, Lecture 24, Resonance.
In connection with the last lecture, in which we discussed the wonderful results of abstraction and generalization from the case of integers, I would like to offer a prize. I don't know what the prize is yet, but I want to offer a prize to the freshmen who belong to the rooming house who will be able to solve this problem first. Now, the rules of the problem are that since the problem has a no well-known solution in the world, we suppose that any freshman who happens to know the solution ahead of time is ineligible to contribute, and you're not supposed to find out from sophomores and so on, but concoct it in your own heads by working together and see which house wins. The problem is, for instance, the following. You know what 3 factorial is? It's 1 times 2 times 3, which is 6. 7 factorial is the product of the integers up to 7, which happens to be 50, 40. Now, these are obviously defined perfectly well for integers. What is 1/2 factorial? That's the problem. Invent a way of defining a factorial so that when they're integers, this is okay. These are the numbers. But when they're not integers, there's another way of getting at them. So find 1/2 factorial to 3 decimal places. Define it in some way or other and calculate the 3 decimal places. The house that wins gets a prize. Another example of powerful generalization, which I don't offer a prize for because I don't think you'll be able to solve it, but maybe you will. You know, if you take the derivatives successively, I write this symbolically this way as the nth derivative of x with respect to f of x with respect to n, it's easy to show that if you take the nth derivative and then of the mth derivative, you get the same thing as the n plus mth derivative. So that the operation of differentiation acts much like a powers. And so the interesting question is to define the operation, or to find an operation which corresponds to differentiating half a time. What does that mean? If n and m are both a half, this would mean that the whatever that operation is, if you first do it to f of x, and then do it to the result, you should get the derivative of f. Find something you can do to f of x so that when you do it again, you get the derivative. See, that would be the half derivative. That's another problem, but that's, I think, a little too hard. However, you can play with it. The other one, to find the factorial, is not at all easy, and we'll see who wins the competition. You must send me an explanation of why you think this is 1/2 factorial, and it calculated correctly to 3 decimal places. And then you get a prize, unknown prize. Okay? All right. Now, we're talking today about continuing our discussion of harmonic oscillators, in particular today, forced harmonic oscillators. But we're going to use a new technique in the analysis of them. Last time, we discussed the fact that a complex number, which has a real and imaginary part, say a general complex number, A is a complex number, it can be represented first on a diagram in which the vertical part will represent the imaginary part and the horizontal part will represent the real part. Later on, I'll call this A sub real plus I A sub imaginary with the obvious implication. The sub R means the real part of A, and the sub I means the imaginary part of A when I write equations in this lecture. That's not a standard notation. Now, on this same triangle, if r is the radius that goes out here, so that r squared is x squared plus y squared, which incidentally, for your information, is a times the complex conjugate of a, sometimes called a star, complex conjugate. That's more or less a universal notation. And then if this angle is theta, we see that the same complex number, A, can be written as R e to the I theta, because, as you now know, or did know before, e to the I theta is the same as cosine theta plus I sine theta. And therefore, since R is R cosine theta plus I R sine theta, and so obviously R cosine theta is X, and R sine theta is Y, and this is X plus I Y as we want, okay? So it's possible to represent a complex number in two forms, in many forms, but we're interested in two forms, a real plus an imaginary part, or a magnitude times a phase angle, so-called. R is called the magnitude, or amplitude, or whatever. It depends on whether you're a mathematician, physicist, or whatever, or modulus or something, of the complex number. And theta is called the phase of the complex number, or the argument of the number, or something. I don't know the names in mathematics, but never mind what they call it. There's a length and an angle. And there's two different ways of representing the complex numbers. Now, we're going to use that by the following trick. We have, I don't want to scare you, but that's going to come later. We have examples of things that oscillate. For example, we have a driving force, which may be a certain constant times the cosine of omega t. Now, this can be written, this f cosine of omega t, can be written as the real part of a complex number, f0 e to the I omega t. Because e to the I omega t is cosine omega t plus I sine omega t, and therefore the real part of it is just cosine. So that if we wanted to write cosines, we can write them as exponentials. The reason is it's easier to play with the exponentials than it is with the cosines. So the whole trick is to represent our oscillatory functions as a real part of some complex functions. E to the I omega t is a complex number, e to the I omega t alone, whose magnitude is 1, and whose component along the horizontal direction is cosine omega t, and whose vertical direction is sine omega t, and whose angle is omega t, and whose length is 1. And therefore, it's a point on the complex plane which revolves at a frequency omega. The complex number f that we have here, this thing is not a real force. It's nonsense, because no force in physics is really complex. I mean, it has an imaginary part. It's only got a real part. We will, however, have an idea. From now on, we will talk about the force as being f0 e to the I omega t. How silly. It's only the real part of that which means anything. So when I say the force is something and write a complex number for it, then please remember that the physical force, the actual force, is only the real part of that. I don't want to have to say that every time, and I don't want a special notation. It turns out easier not to invent one, but to leave it alone. And when you happen to look and see a complex number for the force, well, just take the real part, and you'll find the true force. Let's take another example. Suppose we want to represent a force which is a cosine wave, but out of phase, with a delay phase delta. This, of course, would be the real part of f0 e to the I omega t plus delta. But exponentials being what they are, that is, by the product of two exponentials, is the exponent of the sum, of course. That is, I'm using e to the I omega t plus delta is equal to e to the I omega t, e to the I delta. You see, the algebra of the exponentials is so much easier than the fooling around with sines and cosines. That's the reason why we go through all this funny business with the complex numbers. This is certainly true. And this quantity here, which is a constant independent of time, is a general complex number, which I'll call f. And some people even don't distinguish that. But in this particular lecture, I put a little caret on the top of it, just so because you're not used to having so many letters represent the same thing. This is represent the complex amplitude, so-called, here. And the meaning of it is this, that if this complex number is written out as a magnitude, which we'll call f0, times a phase delta, then the meaning of this is, the real part of this is, f0, the magnitude of the oscillation, and the delta represents the phase shift. If the same f is represented as a real and imaginary part instead of as this form, as we have just done in this form, then I leave you to show the relationship of the real and imaginary part to this, that this force can also be expressed as a sum of a cosine piece and a sine piece. And the cosine piece is the real part of this, and the sine piece is minus the imaginary part of it. But we just use this particular form. In other words, what we're going to be able to do is to represent oscillating functions with phases and amplitudes by simply specifying a complex number, as long as the frequency is fixed in all the analyses. Supposing we know the frequency and all the problem is omega, then we can specify the character of whatever it is that's shaking at frequency omega by giving a complex number. The way to use it is you multiply it by e to the I omega t and take the real part, and that'll translate it back into English. Or you can remember what the translation will be by saying, if I write this in the form f0 e to the I delta, the magnitude of this complex number represents the strength of the force, and the delta represents the oscillating phase delay. So therefore, we can represent oscillations not by giving F0 and delta, but by giving them in this particular combination as a complex number. Well, what good is that? The trick is, of course, the idea is that, well, I will now show you that if I solve an equation using complex numbers, I sometimes, and we'll explain just when and where, can work out the problem for the real case. For instance, we had the forced oscillator last time, which was two times ago, which had a differential equation that looks like this, where F is the force that's on the oscillator, and these are the X's of displacement. Now, absurd though it may be, let's suppose that X and F are actually complex numbers for a mathematical purpose only. Suppose that I solve this equation with complex X and F. That is to say, X has got a real part and an imaginary part times I, while F has a real part and an imaginary part times I. Now, if I had a solution of this with complex numbers, that would mean, by substituting the complex numbers in the equation, that end on the secondary and so on, as you see here, that this equation must be true. And I've rearranged this equation here. The second derivative of the sum, being the second derivative of the first term, plus the second derivative of the second term, you see that this is all right. And this is split up here. So here's the real part of this junk on this on the left side, and here's the imaginary part multiplied by I. But that must be the real part of the force plus the imaginary part of the force. And therefore, since if two complex numbers are equal, their real parts must be equal, and their complex parts must be equal, I deduce that the real part of the of X satisfies the equation with the real part of the force. That means if I would do a problem in which I would have here a force which was conveniently writable as the real part of some complex number, then I could have solved the complex equation and at the end say that the real, the physical X, is the real part of whatever complex number I get for X, you see. In other words, the trick is this. We want to solve for a force here, which is the real part of this. If I write F equals this, F is complex, not the true F in the real problem. But if the complex F over on this side of the line is all complex Fs, then the F could be written as a real thing plus I imaginary. And the real part of this F, the real part of this expression is just this. So what I'm going to do is rather peculiar. I'm going to, instead of writing the correct force on this side of the equation, I'm going to write a complex number, namely this, for the force whose real part is, in fact, the force that I want. Then I have confidence that if I can solve this equation, of course, I'll get an absurd complex X. But when I'm all done, the real part of the X will be the actual motion of the or the displacement. And that's the method of analysis that we will use. I would like to emphasize, however, that this separation into the real part and the imaginary part is not a general valid. It's only valid for equations which are linear, that is, in which every x appears in every term only in the first power. For instance, if there were in the equation a term x squared, then when I got down here, it would be lambda x plus IXI square. But when I separated the real and imaginary parts here, I would have lambda x real squared minus x imaginary squared, and I'd have I lambda times 2 x real xi. So you see that the real part of the equation would not have just lambda xr squared, but would also have lambda xi squared in it with a minus sign. And that's a different equation than the one I wanted to solve. And the xi is a completely nonsensical thing, which is it's artificial in our analysis, and would change the equation, and we're solving the wrong equation. So this trick that the real part satisfies the same equation for the real part of the force is only valid for linear equations. Well, let's try it out for this problem that we know how to solve. Let's see how to do it. We take this equation as before, and we say that we're going to try to solve this f e to the I omega t, a complex number. X will be complex, but remember the rule. Whenever it's complex, take the real part to find out what's really going on. So we try to solve this, and we take the forced solution, so-called. We'll talk about other solutions later. The forced solution has the same frequency as the applied force and has some amplitude of oscillation and some phase. And so it can be represented also by some complex number x, whose magnitude represents the swing of x and whose phase represents the time delay in the same way as the force. So we try this solution. Now, the wonderful part of an exponential is this, that d dt of x is this. If you differentiate exponential, you bring down the power. You know, of course, that the derivative with respect to time of e to the alpha t is alpha e to the alpha t. Using that fact, this becomes I omega x bar e to the I omega x caret, or whatever you call it, e to the I omega t. The second derivative does the same thing. It brings down another I omega. And so with very simple to write down immediately from a differential equation what the equation is for the x bar. Because every time I see a differentiation, I simply multiply by I omega. That is what was so hard, differentiating, is now as easy as multiplication. It's almost as great as the invention of the logarithms, in which multiplication is replaced by addition. Here, differentiation is replaced by multiplication. You can go further someday, perhaps, and invent a way by which differentiation is replaced by addition, but never mind. In this case, we have the equation m times I omega squared plus k times x diggle x bar is equal to f bar. E to the I omega t I left out of both sides. Oh, well, it's a common factor, so you can divide both sides. See how simple it is. So the differential equation is immediately converted to there by sight, and you have then the solution by sight that x bar is equal to f bar times 1 over m times omega, well, say k over m, minus omega square. That's just a tricky thing, because the I omega square is minus omega square, that's all. And I happen to write it k in a complicated well, let me do it. Since we're just learning this for the first time, let's do it slowly. That's clear from here. And therefore, I can also write this thing as 1 over m times omega 0 squared minus omega squared times f, where omega 0 for this is equal to k over m by definition. And that's the solution that we had before. It says that the x has no, since this is a real number, the phase angle of the f and the phase angle of the x are the same, perhaps 180 degrees out if this is negative. At any rate, the x is either exactly in or 180 degrees out of phase of the f, depending on the relative size of omega and omega naught as advertised previously. The size of the x, which measures how far it oscillates, is related to the size of the f by this factor, the size of this factor. And the size of this factor gets enormous when omega is equal nearly to omega 0. And so we get a very high response when we give the right frequency. And so if you take some, hold a thing on the end of a pendulum on the end of a string and just shake the thing just the right frequency, you can make it swing very high. And that's the way we make the same analysis as last time, but with a more elegant mathematical technique. Now, the elegance of the technique is not at all exhibited in such a problem that can be solved anyway so easily. It's only exhibited when you do more difficult problems. So we're going to do another more difficult problem, and furthermore, one which adds a relatively realistic feature to this solution here. Because if the frequency omega were exactly equal to omega zero, this tells us that we have an infinite response. Actually, of course, it doesn't have, there's no infinite response because some other things like friction or something get in the way. So the next problem we want to deal with is a problem in which, beside these terms, there's a friction term added. Ordinarily, such a problem is very difficult because of the character and complexity of the frictional term. There are, however, many circumstances, or we hope there are, huh? Many circumstances, and if there aren't, we design a special piece of equipment that makes sure that it's as nearly true as possible, in which the friction is proportional to the speed that you move the object. An example of such friction is the friction for slow motion of an object in oil or a thick liquid. And so in order to put such a device on, one way is to have a little plunger that has to move through oil with small holes that the oil has to run through. There's no force, of course, if it's just standing still. But the faster you move it, the faster the oil has to go through the holes and so on, and the more the resistance. So we will now assume that there is, in addition to the terms here, I have to erase this. There is, in addition to the terms there, another term, we suppose a resistance force, a frictional force, which is proportional to the velocity. And so it will be proportional to dx dt times some constant or other. It will be convenient in our mathematical analyses. Well, this constant could be called C, for instance. But we would like to write it as m times gamma, for us to simplify the equation a little bit. That is to say, if you want, the gamma is the actual coefficient divided by the mass. That's just the same kind of a trick as we did with the k. We replace it by omega naught square, just to simplify the algebra or the writing. Then our equation will be this, m times the second derivative of x with respect to t plus c times dx dt plus k times x. Well, this C isn't a very good letter. Oh, I'll V, W, X, T. What's the matter with C? B. I don't think I need B for anything. B equals the force over here. Or I write it this way, M times the second derivative with respect to X plus gamma times the first derivative with respect to plus omega 0 squared x is equal to f. That's what I want to do. All right, now we're ready. We got the equation in the form that we want to solve. If gamma is very small, that represents very little friction. If gamma is very large, that represents just a terrible amount of friction. So there we are. Now, how do we solve this equation? Answer. Suppose that we have the problem that the force is equal to some constant times cosine of omega t plus delta. Then you can put that in here and try to solve it. But we will solve it another way. We will write this as the real part of one of these funny f's times e to the I omega t, complex f. We will use a trick with complex forces because you can easily check that when it's linear like this with a dx dt term, the argument that I have erased here is equally valid. Therefore, we suppose that the f is written that way and that the x is equal to some x times e to the I omega t, and substitute this into this equation. Well, it isn't even necessary to do. This derivative twice means I omega twice. The first derivative means I omega. No derivatives is just no derivatives. Times x bar e to the I omega t. That's this side. And the other side is f bar, e to the I omega t. See? Magic. As a matter of fact, if you tried to solve this the other way, you would really appreciate the magic if you try to do it straightforwardly. If If we divide by I to the I omega t on both sides, then we can obtain the response function x, the response x for a given force F, and it's given on the following slide here, blackboard. Namely that by division, what happened? Oh. X bar is equal to F bar divided by the very coefficient which has been written here. The only change going from here to here is that I wrote minus omega square for I omega square, of course, and rearranged the order of the term a little bit. So here we are. X bar is given by F bar times something or other. There's no technical name for this that I know of, and there's no definite letter for it, so that I call it R for a discussion in this lecture only. Although these letter gamma and omega naught are very common in various papers, but this R is not no particular name. So let's say this factor is some factor. It can be either written as P plus IQ, as it's a complex number, or it can be written as a certain magnitude times e to the I theta. Let's see if it's written as a certain magnitude times e to the I theta, what it means. To answer that question, no, that's the wrong, they've got me. I'm surrounded. Oh. Well, let's go back in here somewhere. Oh, here we are. We have that F bar is equal to F0 e to the I delta if the actual force is the real part and is F0 cosine omega t plus delta. Now, this thing tells me that X bar is equal to RF bar, which is equal to rho e to the I theta, that's another name for R, times F, which is F0 e to the I delta. So that X bar is equal to rho F0 times e to the I delta plus theta. Now that means, translating further back, that X, which the X bar e to the I omega t is the same thing times e to the I omega t. And therefore X itself, which is in fact the physical X, which is the real part of the funny X, the complex X, is equal to the real part of this. But rho and F0 are real, and the real part of this is the cosine of omega t plus delta plus theta. And so what it tells us is that the size of the response is the size of the F force multiplied by a certain magnification factor, rho. That gives us the degree of oscillation. The theta, it also tells us, however, that the X is oscillating not in phase with the force, which is at phase delta, but is delayed from the force, or ahead, or whichever way it is. Anyway, you have to think of the sign, by amount theta. Therefore, the rho and the theta represent the size of the response and the phase shift of the response. Now, I've worked out what the rho is. If you have a complex number, they get the rho, the real part, the coefficient here, rather. You can take the magnitude, the number times its complex conjugate, and that gives you rho squared. And if you multiply this one by the complex conjugate, it comes out to this. I'll let you practice with complex number algebra. In addition to angle phase, the phase of this thing is easy, the angle, because this number alone has an imaginary part equal to this and a real part equal to that. And when you have an imaginary and a real part, the tangent of the angle is the real over the imaginary. So you would think you would write theta is the tangent. I mean, the angle whose tangent is the imaginary over the real. Actually, it's minus because it's not this that I want, but the reciprocal, 1 over that. And if I take a reciprocal, I take e to the minus I theta, so I have it upside down. And then, anyway, this comes out to be the theta. I've drawn pictures over here of the way the rho square behaves as a function of frequency, supposing that gamma is fairly small. If gamma were, I'd plot rho square instead of rho. As a matter of fact, that's physically much even more interesting than rho, because the rho square is the mean square deviations or more or less the energy that's developed in the oscillator by the force, because the energy goes as a square. So we plot rho square, and we get this kind of a curve. You see, if gamma is very small, then this thing here is the most important term. You forget this. That's fine, and you get 1 over something, 1 over omega minus omega, omega 0 squared minus omega squared, which is big, when which goes up, tries to go up toward infinity when omega equals omega naught. But now the infinity is kept from being infinite, because if omega equals omega naught, then this thing here is still here, and so it doesn't go to infinity, but comes down on the other side. In the meantime, the phase shift, which you can plot over here, is doing this. I must make one minor remark. Oh, yes, I would like to make a remark, because if you look in all the papers, in books and stuff, at different processes, you will not always find this formula this way. But you'll find a slightly different one, and you might think that it represents a different phenomenon, but it doesn't. The reason is that if gamma is very small, the most interest in the curve is always near omega equal omega zero. And so people have replaced this by an approximate formula, which is very good if gamma is small, and therefore you're near omega equal omega zero. If omega is nearly omega zero, well, anyway, in any case, omega zero square minus omega square is, of course, omega zero plus omega times omega zero minus omega. But if omega is near omega zero, for omega near omega zero, this is nearly 2 omega zero times omega zero minus omega. And the gamma omega term that's in there can be, or, well, that's about, gamma omega is approximately gamma omega zero, because most of the interest in the curve is near omega zero. Using these things in here, we see that another formula, approximate formula, so I put a little wiggle on the thing, it's not exactly equal, but it's nearly equal. If the curve is narrow enough, if the gamma is small enough, you also find this formula all over in all the books. And I just wanted to point out, it looks simpler than this, but it's a good approximation. It's easy to find the corresponding formulas in here and here by, again, taking the real part. It comes out that the real part has an omega minus omega squared plus gamma squared over 4. I leave you to show the following, that if we call the maximum height of the curve 1 unit, and we ask for the width of the curve in frequency at 1/2 the height, that the curve goes through here at 1/2 the height, at omega plus gamma over 2, very closely, very close, supposing gamma small, and omega minus gamma over 2. In other words, the width at half the height of the curve is gamma. In other words, the resonance is sharper and sharper as the resistive effects are smaller and smaller. As a measure of the width, because the gamma has dimensions, it's also possible to measure the width backwards. Talk about how good a resonance is. Some people use this. Omega zero minus omega zero over gamma is defined to be the Q of the resonance. It's only a good thing when gamma is small and the Q is fairly large. The narrower the resonance, the higher the Q. A Q of 1,000 means a resonance whose width is only 1/1,000th of the frequency scale. In other words, if this is zero frequency, this is 1/1,000th. The Q that I've written on the board, since this is approximately what? 1/7. So Q must be 6 or 7 in this case. Now, the importance of the resonance phenomenon is that it occurs in many other circumstances. And so the rest of the lecture will be just to describe some of the other circumstances in which it occurs. The most important or the simplest technical applications are in a system of electricity. In the electrical world, there are a number of possible, there's some elements, electrical elements. Let me explain something about the ideas. In the first place, the whole idea of our oscillator being a mass on the end of a spring is only an approximation. All the mass is not at the mass. some of the mass is in the inertia of the spring. And all of the spring is not in the spring. The mass itself has a little stiffness, and although it doesn't look like it, it's not absolutely rigid, and as it goes up and down, it's slightly pulling it up and down. The same thing is true in electricity. There's only an approximation in which we can lump things into circuit elements. It's not a proper time to discuss that approximation here, so I'll simply assume that it's true under the circumstances. And then we have several different kinds of devices. The first is called a condenser. And this very simple is, you can take an example of two plates connected together with wires that conduct electricity easily. Then if there's a certain voltage difference, that is a certain difference in potential between these terminals, it's the same difference between these terminals because you can't get, if there were any difference along the wire, electricity would flow right away. So there's a certain voltage difference from here to here, and there's a certain charge been delivered to the plates, electric charge, Q, having nothing to do with this Q. It's a different Q. There's a certain charge Q on the plates. Then there'll, of course, be a certain electric field. We even found a formula for it. And if you integrate it from here to here, you find the voltage difference on the plates. Now look, if I double the charge, it doesn't make any difference about the geometry of the plates. I double the charge. I double the field everywhere, of course, because the charge doubled makes twice as much field. And therefore, I'll double the line integral, and I'll double the voltage. Therefore, any device of this nature, the voltage, which is called E in electricity, in spite of E being the electric field. The electrical engineers call E the voltage. I can't help it. I got to use their letters. Is equal to the charge times some constant. It's proportional to the charge. This constant is called 1 over C, and C is called the capacity of the object, and the object is usually called a condenser. Now, I said that disregarded the fact that it takes a little push to get, once the charge is collected here, everything's all right. But if the charge wants to discharge, it takes a little push to drive it through the wires. It turns out that wires resist the flow of electricity in this manner, that if there's a voltage difference across a piece of wire, there'll be a current that flows that's proportional to the electric voltage difference. And the coefficient is called the resistance. And we'll discuss all these matters when we take up electricity. I'm only trying to show the relation or analogy between electrical systems and mechanical systems in detail. This is the resistance times the current. The current, electric current, is the amount of charge that passes per second, or dq dt. So that the electric force across such a terminal makes a change in the charge. Now, it's very interesting that there exists an electrical machinery, or electrical devices, rather, not machinery, I mean just gadgets, things, circuit elements, and an object which is the analog of a mass. And this is a coil which is to build up a magnetic field within itself. A changing magnetic field develops a voltage, and the magnetic field is proportional to a current. So the voltage in such a coil is proportional to the change in the current. Details to be explained later in another next year. At any rate, there is possible to find to design an element that is nearly true, that E is a constant called the inductance times di dt, or L equal the second derivative of Q with respect to T. This is called a capacitance, a resistance, and an inductance. Suppose we take a circuit in which we have connected the three in this way with wires. Then the voltage across the whole thing from here to here is the work done in carrying a charge through the whole works and consists of the sum of several pieces. Across the inductance, L, the second derivative of Q with respect to T. Across the resistance, R dQ dT. Across the condenser, 1 over CQ. That's equal to the applied voltage E. Now you see that that equation is exactly the same as the mechanical equation that we wrote over here. And it can be solved in exactly the same manner. We suppose that E is oscillatory. If we're driving this thing with a generator with a definite sine wave oscillation, then we can write our E as one of these complex E's with the understanding that it must be ultimately multiplied by E to the I omega t in the real part taken in order to find the true E. Likewise, the charge can be thus analyzed. And then in exactly the same manner as over there, I write the corresponding equation. The second derivative is I omega squared. The first derivative is I omega. No derivative. Done. Q is equal to E divided by this junk. And it's exactly the same junk as we had in the other case with the same kind of a resonance phenomenon and so forth. It does exactly the same thing because it's the same equation. The correspondence is as follows, that L corresponds to the mass, What corresponds to the gamma over there, the way we've defined it, is R over L. That is the coefficient of this term divided by the mass. The 1 over C corresponds to the stiffness of the spring, or not case. And so the stiffness divided by the mass, that is 1 over LC, is omega 0 squared. That is, if you have a circuit of very low resistance, the resonant frequency is given by the square root of 1 over LC. So the formula, the square root of K over M for omega, for a mechanical system, becomes in an electrical system 1 over the square root of the inductance times the capacitance. Now, there's a small technical point, just so you'll be able to read electrical literature to see the trouble is from one field to another, not that the subject is any different, but that the way of writing, that the notations and so on are all different. For instance, one of the things that they do is that they use J instead of I in electrical engineering. That's because they insist that I must be the current. So let's say I is dq dt, and they would rather have their relationship between E and I than between E and Q. That's just technical, just because they're used to it. Now, I is dq dt, and if you write Q is equal to Q bar e to the I omega t, since it's the derivative, the corresponding I will be I omega times Q bar. Therefore, I can just substitute for Q bar I over I omega and get to this equation here. Another way is to rewrite the equation using, so that it looks more familiar, you'll see the electrical engineers will write it this way, L di dt, Ri, and 1 over C times Q, which is the time integral of I. At any rate, we find the relation between electric field and current, which is just the same as the one that I've written here with charge, except divided by I omega, and that produces this formula. This particular quantity in this particular circuit is a complex number, and is used so much in electrical engineering that it's got a name. It's a complex number, and it's called the complex impedance. So that we can write that the voltage is equal to Zi. The reason they like to do that is they were used to, they learned something when they were young. E equals IR for resistances, when they only knew about resistances in DC. Now, when they become more educated and have AC circuits, they want the equation to look the same. So they write E bar equals Zi. And the only difference is then that the resistance is replaced by a more complicated thing and a complex number. And that's the technique which is used in electrical engineering. It's a miracle that they didn't insist that this letter be also an R. They so insist that this be an I that they can't use what everybody else in the world uses for imaginary numbers. They have to use a J for that. Then they get into trouble when they're talking about current densities, which they also use J for. Well, never mind. The difficulties of science are mostly the difficulties of the notations, the units, and all that other junk which are invented by man, not by nature. Now I would like to, although we've discussed the electrical case in detail, to show you term for term how the equation is the same. There are many circumstances in nature in which something is oscillating and in which this resonance phenomenon occurs. I said that in an early lecture. I would now like to demonstrate it. And what I did was I walked around my room and I pulled books off the shelf and simply look through the books to find an example of such a curve and that correspond to this, and came from the same equation. And just to demonstrate the wide range, I've taken the smallest possible sample of these things. I just took 5 or 6 that I found in my own room, plus going down to see Mr. Morsbauer to get one particular slide that was better than the one in the book I had. Anyhow, here is a series of phenomena which show resonances. The first two will be mechanics, and one will be large-scale mechanics, and that is the atmosphere of the whole Earth. If the atmosphere of the Earth, which is supposed to surround it nice and evenly on all sides, is pulled to one side by the moon, say, in a tide, or rather squashed or blade like the moon does, you know, it makes a double tide, and you let go, it would go poing, 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 poing. It's an oscillator. And so this oscillator is driven, however, by the actual moon, which is revolving. So any one component of the force, say in the x direction, has a cosine component. And so the moon, the response of the Earth's atmosphere to the motion of the moon, to the tide of the moon, is that of an oscillator. Now, we only have in one point on this. We only have the one frequency. Just look at curve B. The A is to show something is impossible. We only have the one frequency corresponding to the rotation of the Earth under the moon. And that occurs at a period of 12.42 hours. course, the Earth, 12 hours for the Earth and 24, but it's a double bump. 12 hours for the Earth plus a little more because the moon's going around. And from the point, from the size of the atmospheric tides and from the phase, how are they delayed, from both the, we get rho and theta. And from those, we can get omega zero and gamma and just draw the entire curve. This is an example of very poor science. From two numbers, we obtain two numbers. And from those two numbers, we draw a beautiful curve, which of course goes through the very point that determined the curve. It's no use unless you can measure something else. And in the case of geophysics, that's often very difficult. But in this particular case, there's another thing which you can show theoretically must be the same timing, the same as the natural frequency omega zero. And that is, if someone would disturb the thing alone, it would oscillate at the frequency omega zero if there was a sharp disturbance. And there was a sharp disturbance in 1880-something. The Krakatoa volcano exploded and half the island blew off, and it made such a terrific noise in the atmosphere that the long wave of oscillation of the atmosphere period could be measured and came out 10 and a half hours. Well, this comes out 10 hours and 20 minutes for the frequency omega zero, so there is at least one check on the reality of our understanding of the atmospheric tides. Next, we go to the small-scale mechanical oscillation. This time, we take a sodium chloride crystal, which has sodium ions and chlorine ions, as we've described in the early lecture, next to each other. These are electrically charged on the average, plus and minus. They are, of course, in all space, so. Now, there's an interesting oscillation possible. Suppose that I could drive all the plus charges to the right and all the negative ones to the left and let go. They would oscillate this way. The whole, all the carbon, the chlorine and the sodium oscillate next to each, opposite each other. How could I ever derive such a thing? Very easy. If you put an electric field on here, you'll push the charges one way and the other charge the other way. So by having external electric field, we can get the thing to oscillate. The frequency of the electric field is so high, however, that it corresponds to infrared radiation. And so we find the following, this curve for the absorption of infrared light by sodium chloride. The maximum corresponds to, here it's not frequency, but it's given in terms of wavelength, but that's just technical. Of course, for a wave, or like infrared, there's a definite relation between frequency and wavelength. So it's really a frequency scale, and this frequency corresponds to the resonant frequency. But what about the width? What determines the width? I must say that in technical experiments, I didn't select this one too well, because there are many cases in which the width that is seen on the curve is not really the natural width gamma that you would have theoretically. I don't know in this case what is which, whether there's an error or not, but I must point out there are two reasons why there can be a wider curve than the theoretical curve. Let me have the lights a moment. Thank you. If the objects don't all have the same frequency, like you have a whole lot of atoms in a box, or the crystal is strained in certain regions, so in those regions, the oscillation frequency is slightly different than in other regions, then what we're having is really, when we do the experiment, a whole lot of these curves on top of each other, and so we apparently get a wider curve. The other kind of width is simply this, that we can't measure the frequency right. That, for instance, when we use this, I don't know how it was done, but suppose in this infrared, we open the slit of the spectrometer fairly wide, so although we thought we had one frequency, we actually had little width. Then we can't have the resolving power to see a narrow curve. So I'm not sure in this example what this width is due to, whether it's natural, whether it's a spread due to inhomogeneities in the crystal, or whether it's a spread due to the experimental width of the slit. I didn't have time to find out. Now we turn to a more esoteric example, and that is the swinging of a magnet. If we have a magnet, north and south poles, and a magnetic field, the magnet will be pulled, the north this way, the south that way, and there'll be a torque on it. However, the magnets that we're talking about are atoms, and these atoms have an angular momentum. They're spinning. And so as a consequence of their angular momentum, the torque does not produce a simple motion in the direction of the field, but instead of that, of course, a precession. Now, looked at from the side, any one component, that's a swinging. And we can disturb that swinging from the side and measure an absorption. And so this curve represents, as it would be at first, as a function of frequency, and I'll show you that it isn't exactly in a moment, a typical resonance curve What has done here is slightly different technically. The frequency of the sideways field that's used to detect the swinging that's used here is always kept the same. While we would have expected they would vary that and plot the curve, they could have done it that way. But technically, it was mechanically easier for them to leave this frequency fixed and change this field. What that corresponds to is to change in our formula omega zero. The external field at the top here, this changes omega zero. So what they have actually done is plotted it backwards. They've plotted the curve against omega zero here. Anyway, that's a typical resonance with a natural width that's determined from the apparatus, from the device, from the phenomenon itself. Now we go on still further. And this has to do with nuclei. The motion of neutrons and protons and so on in nuclei are oscillatory in certain ways. And we can I have the next slide, please? Demonstrate that by the following experiment. We bombard a lithium atom with protons. And we discover that the reaction, producing gamma rays actually, has a rather sharp maximum of the type. This is the same curve when it was taken. This is multiplied by 1/10 of the type of a resonance. You will note here, however, one difference than other cases. Here, the energy, the scale is not a frequency, it's an energy. And that is because in quantum mechanics, what we think of classically as the energy will turn out to be really related to a frequency of our wave amplitude. And this is a demonstration, in fact, of this relationship in a sense. Namely, that when we analyze something which in the simple physics has to do with a frequency, we find that when we do quantum mechanic experiments with real matter to get the corresponding curves as a function of energy, shows that frequency and energy have some deep interrelationship, which of course they do. So here is a curve of a nuclear energy level measured as a function of the showing a resonance phenomenon. Now I turn to another example in which there's another nuclear level, but a much, much narrower one. And this energy of this, the omega zero, corresponds to an energy of 100,000 electron volts. Well, you see that the width here is approximately 10 to the minus 5th electron volts. In other words, this is a Q of 10 to the 10th. When this curve was measured, it was the largest Q of any oscillator that had ever been measured. It was measured by Mr. Morsbauer, and it was the basis of his Nobel Prize. The scale here is velocity. The technique for obtaining the slightly different frequencies was to use the Doppler effect and to move the source relative to the absorber. And you see how delicate the experiment is when you realize that the speeds involved are a few centimeters a second. See, something like this. And you're talking about the correction because of this relative to the speed of light. The speed of that relative to the speed of light is the precision with which you have to make measurements in order to see that curve on the basis, on the background of it. Finally, I thought, when I had all these slides, and I thought, well, I better look in the last issue of the Physical Review. The Physical Review letters, January 1st, 1962. Is there a resonance curve? Every issue has a resonance curve, and here's a resonance curve. And this resonance curve turns out to be very interesting. It's a resonance in a certain reaction among strange particles, a reaction in which a K minus and a P interact. The resonance is detected by seeing how many of something else come out, and depending on what comes out, you get different size curves, but the same shape in the same place. And we thus determine that there's a resonance at a certain energy for the K meson. That means that there's presumably some kind of a state of energy corresponding to this resonance in a system which can be gotten to by putting together a K minus and a P. This is a new particle or resonance. We today don't know whether to call a bump like this a new particle or a resonance. When there's a very sharp resonance, it corresponds to a very definite energy, just as though there were a new particle of that energy present in nature. When the resonance gets wider, then we don't know whether to say, well, there is a particle, but it doesn't last very long, or it's a resonance. And if you look at the second lecture, this point is made in the second lecture about the particles. But when the second lecture was given, this resonance was not known. And so our chart should have still another particle in it. The name of this one is still not decided, Some people call it the Y-naught double star. Anyway, you see, progress goes on through the measurement of resonances. Thank you. That's what I'll be able to do, but I'll do that if they're not. But I have to remember your name again.
Seltzer.
Oh, yeah, that's right, right. Okay, well, then I'll know what they're asking about. Thank you. I won't be able to say much, as you say, but I will. Questions to them, either completely obscure or absolutely clear, or neither, sort of dull and done and nobody cares a damn. You can write a good mystery story. The idea would be that something happens in this lecture room, and in order to communicate, to point out the crook, the lecturer makes a mumbling, you see, while the guy up at the top hears it.
What? No.
See, and something happens. He goes off and gets the police. God knows what.
That's a way of frustrating the hell out of this.
What?
That's a way of frustrating the hell out of this.
What? You can't write the equations in it.
Well, sure.
Oh.
No, not that I couldn't get it out. What is omega naught? When he talks about what the width of this plastic thing, what is omega naught?
Well, the omega naught on the Morsbauer slide wasn't given. That wasn't on the slide because it was so narrow that you couldn't plot it. So it was down in the moon somewhere. If you plotted it, let's see. That's for fun. Where it would be, the curve was this wide.
Yeah, on the slide.
On the slide, say it was this wide. Which is what? Say a foot, 10 centimeters, say. Yeah. All right. And now it's 10 to the 10th times that, which is 10 to the 11th centimeters. Yeah. And 10 to the 11th centimeters is 10 to the 6th kilometers, right? Uh-huh. So that is beyond the moon by a factor 2, you see. So in order, if you wanted me to have the omega naught on that curve, I'd have to have the scale out to the moon, you see. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. No, I didn't have time. I mean, it wasn't the point to really understand each of the slides, but to appreciate that you do, that this stuff is the same curve, the same phenomenon, again and again, in a wide range of physical phenomena. It's just an example of all the electrical phenomena, masers and ACE and, do you want this?
This thing here, but not that. I mean, they said, all right, impedance is analogous in an AC circuit to resistance in a DC. But what? Why? I don't know. They just drew a couple graphs.
Well, I've thrown a couple of things, too. Maybe it helps, maybe it doesn't.
I don't know. I think it would be a relationship between that
Yeah, well, I was trying to explain to you that you've really learned something, you know, that's more useful. And you just pay attention when you see it in another case that if you think a minute, you've already studied that. Well, if you leave all the letters different and everything's upside down, you don't know that you're doing the same thing over again. No.
He turned to me up there as he was walking out and he said, well, you guys are sure going to be bored in graduate school.
You want your apparatus back?
Yeah,
is that all I'm worth? Well, they tell me that the guts that I made out of it worth about a couple of...